came back from Gururadam. It was an intense few days. I'm still a little bit, the vibration is still there. But at the same time, I was a bit tired, so forgive me. But I'm looking full edge of my vitality. I beg all the assembled, especially senior Vaishnavas, to give me the blessing to be able to speak something today. And mostly I'm anyway speaking to myself. Because this is what I need myself the most. However, I thought about a very nice verse, which we will say, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Today I want to read about from Bhagavad Gita, of course, chapter 9, verse 26. Who knows the books? 26. How is it? It's glatt. The glatt vers. Wasser vers. Genau. This is the verse. I have. I read it in Sanskrit first, and then translation. Patram pushpam palam toyam yo me bhaktya pucha prayachati tad aham bhakti upharitam asnami prayatat manaha. Translation. If one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, flower, a fruit or water, I will accept. Perfect. For the intelligent person, it is essential to be in Krishna consciousness. Who is here for the first time? Just to let you know. For the first time? Cool. May I submit some alas, madam?
Yes.
Are you a new person?
Dieses Jahr das erste Mal.
Dieses Jahr, ja. In der Dekade sozusagen. So, also du bist das erste Mal, ja? Cool. Mit wem bist du alleine hergekommen? Männliche Begleitung. Schön, dass du da bist. Bist du aus Berlin? Bist du aus Berlin?
Ja, nee.
You're from Berlin?
No, no, we are from Belarus, but we live in Berlin.
Okay, wow. Okay. So, in English is okay. So, for the intelligent person, it is essential to be in Krishna consciousness, engaged in the transcendent loving service of the Lord in order to achieve a permanent blissful abode of eternal happiness. Isn't that a nice one? In order to achieve a permanent blissful abode of eternal happiness. Who doesn't want to have a permanent abode of eternal happiness? You don't want to come there? Okay. The process of achieving such a marvelous result is very easy and can be attempted even by the poorest of the poor, without any kind of qualification. The only qualification required in this connection is to be a pure devotee of the Lord. It does not matter what one is or where one is situated. The process is so easy that even a leaf or a little water or fruit can be offered to the Supreme Lord in genuine love, and the Lord will be pleased to accept it. No one, therefore, can be barred, means ausgeschlossen, from Krishna consciousness because it is so easy and universal. Who is such a fool that he does not want to be Krishna conscious by this simple method, and thus attain the highest perfectional stage of eternity, bliss, and knowledge? Krishna wants only loving service and nothing more. He wants only loving service and nothing more. Krishna accepts even a little flower from his pure body. He does not want any kind of offering from non-devotees. He is not in need of anything from anyone because he is self-sufficient. And yet, he accepts the offering of his devotee in exchange of love and affection. To develop Krishna consciousness is the highest perfection of life. Bhakti is mentioned twice in this verse in order to declare more empathically that bhakti or devotional service is the only means to approach Krishna or God. No other condition, such as becoming a brahmana, a learned scholar, a very rich man, or a great philosopher, can induce Krishna to accept some offering. Without the basic principle of bhakti, nothing can induce the Lord to agree to accept anything from anyone. Strong words, I mean, quite some powerful words, Prabhupada's. So bhakti is never causal. What does that, that's actually a nice one too. Also es ist nicht kausal. What does that mean? Bhakti is not causal. What were you saying?
So I do something for you, Krishna, and then you repay me.
So it's not a deal, huh? Like you can't really deal with God. I'm around since so many years, and therefore you now have to finally perform some miracles in my life. That's a good point. Yeah. So it's not causal. It means it is not bound by cause and effect. There's no cause related to the effect of bhakti. That means it has been done without any motivation. I'll come to that. This process is eternal. It is direct action in service to the absolute whole. Here, Lord Krishna, having established that he is the only enjoyer, that was before, the primeval Lord, and the real object of sacrificial offering, in the verses before, he reveals what type of sacrifice he desires to be offered. So if one wishes to engage in devotional service to the Supreme in order to be purified and reach the goal of life, the transcendental loving service of God, then one should find out what the Lord desires of him. That's another nice point, because we usually think of ourselves as persons, but as soon as we come to, you know, God, then we feel like, yeah, well, you know, that's kind of an object I can either make a deal with, or it's an object I deny a personal taste or likes and dislikes. That doesn't mean that God necessarily likes what we like and dislikes what we dislike, but there is a liking and a disliking also on the absolute platform. And in order to understand that liking and disliking of God, that is the intimacy of bhakti. So we need to find out, what does God like? What doesn't, and what doesn't he like? That's important part. So, he loves whatever he wants, exactly. So he said, right? If one wishes to engage in devotional service to the Supreme Lord in order to be purified and to reach the goal of life, the transcendental loving service of God, then one should find out what the Lord desires of him. One who loves Krishna will give him whatever he wants, and he avoids offering anything which is undesirable or unasked. Also interesting. So it's not about what I like, I want to offer to God, but it's more like what he likes, I will perform, what I will do for him. So first I have to find out what does Krishna like, what are his feelings, his priorities, his favorite dishes, his favorite clothing, his favorite fragrances. And then once we find out what he likes, then I can prepare things that he likes. It's a bit like, you know, we just had Christmas, and you know, there are always so many presents you kind of get and you feel like it's nice. Thank you. You know, and that you see that person thought about what could possibly match to your psychological structure or physical structure or to your beautician trend, and then you get something, but then somehow or other, you know, you realize already, okay, anyway, won't use that, so it comes in the back. think of who can want that, so then you might give this to somebody else. But there are a few people who actually know you very well, and they give you something where you feel like, wow, this is really done with affection. That person really thought, what do I like? And that present is something special. Or you might have got many WhatsApp and emails like Happy New Year and all of this, but you quickly realized, which was just an automation thing, huh? People just send to all their contacts, and I never reply to those because I feel this is not really personal. You know, why should I now be personal if somebody else comes with a Serienbrief? You know, then I should not be. So then usually I did not reply. But if somebody said, "Hey, Moody, you know, it's nice." You know, somebody's very personal for me. You know, then I feel a bit like, oh yeah, that's nice. Then I have to wish something back. It's a nice exchange of love. But it has to be personal. So the Lord also, he's a person, he likes transcendent loving person, things he likes and whatever he wants. And we should avoid the offering what is not desirable by him or what is not asked. So thus, meat, fish and eggs should not be offered to Krishna. If he desired such a thing as an offering, he would have said so. So he would have said. But instead, he clearly requests that a leaf, a fruit, a flower, and water be given to him. And he says, of this offering, I will accept. Therefore, we should understand that he will not accept meat, fish, and eggs, vegetables, grains, fruits, milk. We could argue about it. Being a vegetarian, maybe that's not the right place, but let's say in that frame, when that was written, the cow was a happy cow. So, you know, milk, water, they are proper food for human beings and are prescribed by Krishna himself. Whatever else we eat cannot be offered to him, since he will not accept. Thus, we cannot be acting on the level of loving devotion if we offer such fruits. So it is some devotion if we offer something we think is okay, but loving devotion, which is a distinction. There is a distinction between a loving devotion approach, if we know what the other person likes. And basically, the distinction is between karma yoga and bhakti yoga. Karma yoga means I work whatever I like, and the fruits of my activities I offer to Krishna. Could be that I give 50% of my money each month. Could be that I buy fruits I like, and then I just offer it on the altar, and then, you know, I take it for myself. So that is, there is a mixture of karma yoga. But pure bhakti, as Krishna explains, the pure devotee always wants to find out what does the other person like, and that is what I want to offer. So, last paragraph. In the third chapter, verse 13, Sri Krishna explains that only the remains of sacrifice are purified and fit for consumption by those who are seeking advancement in life and release from the clutches of material entanglement. Those who do not make an offering of their food, he says in the same verse, are eating sin. In other words, their every mouthful is simply deepening their involvement in the complexities of material nature. This for this. The complexities of material nature. But preparing nice simple vegetable dishes, offering them before the picture of the deity of Krishna, and bowing down and praying for him to accept such a humble offering, enables one to advance steadily in life, to purify the body, and to create fine brain tissues, which will lead to clear thinking. Above all, the offering should be made with an attitude of love. Again, Prabhupada is very strong on that point. Krishna has no need for food, since he is already possessing everything that be. Yet he will accept the offering of one who desires to please him in that way. The important part in preparation, in serving, and in offering is to act with love for Krishna. And the very last one. The impersonalist philosophers who wish to maintain that the absolute truth is without senses, means without senses, also without a mind, means without desires, without likes and dislikes, they cannot comprehend this verse of Bhagavad Gita. To them, it is either a metaphor or a proof of the mundane character of Krishna, the speaker of Bhagavad Gita. So they think, like, because the Lord has a desire like me, so then he must be in total like me, so he also has to be a mundane, materialistic mindset of desires. Or that means, you know, they would understand it in the way that is just an analogy. Like, he likes things, but that is just an analogy for something else. So he likes fruit, water, and a leaf, but that actually stands for something. So they would symbolize, rather, those meanings. So, but in actuality, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he has senses. And it is stated that his senses are interchangeable, as it is a vartoshpa. In other words, one sense can perform the function of any other. This is what is what means to say that Krishna is absolute. Lacking senses, he could hardly be considered full in all opulences. So Prabhupada explains it in a way, if God is absolute, then he also needs to have senses. Otherwise, he would not be called absolute. Because absolute means he possesses all qualities anybody could possibly think of. And that also includes the possibility that he has a sense, and that he has a desire, and that he wants things and doesn't want other things. So that is what it means to say Krishna is absolute. In the seventh chapter, Krishna has explained that he impregnates the living entities into this material nature, and this is done by his looking upon material nature. And so in this instance, Krishna's hearing the devotee's words of love in offering foodstuff is wholly identical with his eating and actually tasting. So by looking on, it's the same as tasting. This point should be emphasized, so Prabhupada, once more. Because of his absolute position, his hearing is wholly identical with his eating and tasting. Only the devotee who accepts Krishna as he describes himself without interpretation can understand that the Supreme Absolute Truth can eat food and enjoy it. So once more, the verse. If one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or water, I will accept it. So, yeah. It's a nice verse, because today I want to speak about the power of intention. And of course I want to make it interactive, so if somebody has some information he wants to share in that regard, we can either do it in between, or in the end we can save some 10 minutes to get more into the interactive part. And I want to talk about what is intention, and how we use our intention to perform pleasing devotional service for Krishna. You all know about if somebody is giving you a blessing or if somebody is cursing you. Well, we had that experience. If somebody would say, "Ah, come on, I hate you," then you know already in the way that person is saying, he doesn't really hate you. But if somebody really is emotionally hurt, and if somebody is really, I don't want to say it, you know the difference, although the words are the same. Or somebody is blessing you, and he says, I wish you all the best. How do you feel like, okay, thank you. Or, you know, the difference if somebody says, Prabhupada, I really wish you that you can really, with your lecture, touch people's heart, that you'd be an instrument of Krishna to change the consciousness of everybody in the room. Then you feel that blessing has another impact on you. Although it might be the same words, even. So, what do we do? Words are usually carrier objects. So, we have, like, in medical backgrounds, we maybe you know about homeopathy, where you have certain globulis or water, and then these globulis are carrier objects of what is actually the information we want to carry to that patient. So you have certain plant remedies, you have certain Bach flower remedies, let's say, and those remedies are as an informational content stored on those carrier objects. So in the same way, we use language as carrier objects. And we can say, I hate you, or we can say, I hate you. And these are the same words, but because the intention is different, the information, the content is different, what you put underneath that words. Therefore, one time a person responds happy, another time a person may be responding angry. Because this is the same carrier object, but different information content. So, what do we need in order to have the right intention? I want to, you know, build a little bridge today, and I want to point out three things we are needing according to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's bhakti. That's the main ingredient. It's vairagya, and it is jnana. So just keep that in mind. Bhakti, vairagya, and jnana. And during the time I will talk, I will come to these points to connect them to the right intention we need. So these ones we need. So what I like about this verse very much to start with is that Krishna is mentioning we don't need very much. You know, he's not saying you need gold. He's not saying you need jewels, rubies, diamonds, silver, 2 million cows, or, you know, 10,000 camels. You know, you don't need to be opulent materially. Actually, he's pointing out that whatever you need, there is a leaf. Everybody has a leaf. Everybody has some fruits, flowers, water. People can afford it. It's not costly. So first of all, Krishna is making a very strong point. It's not about the form. It's not about the material object we are offering. You might have heard that in the previous yuga, in the Dwapara yuga, there was another process by which a soul could become liberated. What was that? Dwapara yuga. Deity worship. So, and the deity worship being done was, if we read the Vedic scriptures, very, very opulent. And they really had gold, jewels, they had a lot of diamonds, costly food stuff. And actually, the whole wealth of a village or of a city would be where the temple is. And you sometimes still see that in India. For example, I was once in Varanasi. I don't know whether one of you has been to the Kashi Vishwanath Mandir, one of the, I would say, most famous Shiva temples in India. There are more, of course. And it has, maybe you can Google that up in your home, but it has a fully golden dome. It's not massive gold, but I guess it's like this thing. So it has a huge, you look at it and you feel like, wow, how is that? If one would sell that, would be a multi-trillionaire, I don't know. So, and that is just one example. Of course, in India, you sometimes have this. Sri Rangam is also a very rich place, very opulent temple. Mostly in South India, that is more still related to the traditional Vedic culture. So you can still see wealth and opulence was stored by the temple. And maybe there's also some wealth. I don't recommend you plundering.
Well hidden.
Well hidden. Jonathan has an eye on it. And whoever wants to steal something. So, but of course, in the time, you know, when the Muslims came and the British came, you know, they, you know, it's not just that they like to, you know, give education and all that stuff, but they also took something. And we all know how the history went. So that was there, because the deity worship was very opulent, and the deity worship was meant to be very opulent. Also in Dwapara Yuga, people were also, they were rich. There was no shortage of, you know, money and wealth and all that thing. So it was normal to just give opulent offerings. In Kali Yuga, and maybe that is one reason why the Lord is already mentioning in this verse, just a leaf, just some water, water you have, even Berlin, you know, fruits, organic you might have. So then already, maybe because it was beginning of Kali Yuga, and those of you who have read the 12th Canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, where the end of Kali Yuga is described, it becomes even harder than it is right now. There will be scarcity of foodstuff. There will be just a little grain on the fields, and water will not fall really. There will be a lot of deserts, and so on. It's not a very nice scenario. However, the Lord, being Trikalakya, knowing past, present, and future, He would already know how Kali Yuga would progress, so then He would maybe say, water you might even have at the end of Kali Yuga, hopefully. But anyway, above all, what Prabhupada said, it's not about the form. So, if you have, of course you can, and you should, but that is secondary. But primary is that we do what Prabhupada says with a loving intention. In quantum physics, they say mind over matter. You have heard about that one, mind over matter. The Geist is über der Materie. Or that the Geist formed die Materie. Mind forms matter. So we, you know, in quantum physics, there is a strong statement that actually the mind is responsible for material forms. There is a time span in between my thinking or somebody's thinking and this laptop manifesting in front of you, but that was an intelligent mind having an idea of making this thing work, and then somehow it manifested. So that principle also Krishna is promoting in the Bhagavad Gita. He says it's not about the form, it's not about what you offer actually. More important is how you do it. So we heard this in our life, huh? We have what versus how. So what is more important, it's not about what you do, but it's about how you do it. And that principle also Krishna is establishing in this verse very strongly, that we should not so much think about the form, how we do some offering, but that we should more or less focus on the attitude, or as Prabhupada said, the intention. Therefore today is about the power of intention. What does intention mean? You know, if you look it up online, you would say intention is the purpose, intention is the attitude, the inner attitude of how you do things. It is your, yeah, we quickly say intention. So it is actually the attitude behind our activities and our words. Because usually we have a thing called there's a thought, and then from the thought somehow the words develop, because we speak what we think, and from what we talk we usually, that's what we walk, so that means that determines our activities. So it is coming from subtle again to gross, mind over matter. It's the same principle. So there is a nice guy called William Blake. I don't know whether you heard about him. I have a nice quote of him. He is a British poet. And he has a nice one. I want to, because it rhymes, and it only rhymes in English, so that's why I'm reading it. He says, a truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent. That's a nice one. Yeah, the English translated nicely. So the truth is,
they are all proper qualities can also find in the theories of the three Junas.
Was heißt auf Deutsch?
Also sind alle Eigenschaften, denen man so in der Materie begegnet, in den drei Gunas vertreten?
This is a good point. I'll come to that actually, because this is a good point you're asking. How much does the three modes of material nature are influencing our intention? Because that is a very good point. I'll come to that. So keep in mind, it's good. So he says, a truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent. So if somebody is speaking the truth, but there's a bad intention behind. So it's again, it's not about the form, but it's about the substance. You might even talk the truth, but the intention is wrong. That has a the effect is worse than if you lie, but you might have a good intention. So it's again, it's not about the form. It's a very nice one. So, that good intention, the outcome of what we call this so-called good intention is usually sometimes even devastating. Why is that? Because this good intention is connected to the ego. This good intention is connected to the polluted mind. Or you would say the good intention mixed with the ego is influencing the consciousness, and therefore the outcome can actually justify the greatest evil. So the good intention mixed with the ego of I have some personal ambition in that story can justify the very evil outcome of the whole story. So, because every war, as we know, it has an intention. It's not just that, you know, we want to secure peace. That would be nice. But every war has the intention of, let me get some resources from them, because they have more than what we have. And we have to secure our resource supply from somewhere else, because it's running down where we are right now. So, the intention of maybe securing peace is mixed with the cause the ego of I need more of my resources, and therefore I have to make sure, you know, I get the resources from them, and therefore the outcome is quite brutal. So we have to check that. There is a nice verse in Bhagavad Gita. Oh, by the way, there's another good English one. It says, "The way to hell are paved with good intentions." You know that one? Der Weg zur Hölle ist gepflastert mit guten Intentionen. So that's a saying in English. And there's one nice verse in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, verse 32. It says, that understanding which considers irreligion to be religion, and religion to be irreligion, this is what in Kali Yuga is often the case, and that understanding under the spell of illusion and darkness, and strives always in the wrong direction, O Partha. This is the mode of ignorance. To take religion for a religion, the understanding which takes religious principles actually for a religion, and to take irreligious principles and declaring it as a religion. That is an understanding in the mode of ignorance. What is the solution? It's a good point. Yeah? I mean, now we have to see that. So it's not that all the good intentions are always good. Subjectively, the person wants good, but the outcome is not always as we want it, basically. So what's the solution? The solution should actually be that the intention is based on a foundation of real knowledge. And there comes the first word, Gyan, into consideration. Remember, it's Bhakti, Vairagya, and Gyan. So first we need Gyan, and not just... You know, there's Gyan versus information. Because the nature of information is very temporary. Nobody would read a newspaper which is 2 days old, or even 1 week old, or let's say you read a newspaper from last year. It's boring. Why? Because the information are so temporary that already a few weeks, days later, this is not really, it's not relevant anymore. However, real jnana, or knowledge, is of universal principle. That means it's as relevant 5,000 years ago as it is relevant today. That means whatever is in Bhagavad Gita, and you can read the verses, if you read the verses, then you feel that is part of my life. I can fully identify with all the verses. Some verses more and some less, but it's not like, oh yeah, it's 5,000 years old, what do I need? You know, that's not really relevant today. However, a newspaper based on information is temporary. It's about who's the president in this country and what's the Latin name of this plant and, you know, what's the new product coming out in this country. That's all temporary and will go away. So therefore, we have to distinguish between what is information and what is real knowledge. These two are very crucial. So we need jnana, we need real knowledge based on a real source. So we need actually universal, transcendental truths we base our intention on. Because we need to know, we need the power of discrimination. Basically, that's what it's for. Because we need to know what is good for us and what is not good for us. We need a, like in this verse of the Bhagavad Gita, we need to know what is religious and what is irreligious, or what brings us towards our goal and what is actually blocking us from reaching that goal. So that is important. And we can only have that power of discrimination if we base our intention or our daily words and activities on real knowledge. Otherwise, it's not possible. So, jnana is very important. Prabhupada gave a very nice story of a mother who wants to care with a good intention for her child. And the child has typhus fever. And somehow or other, I never had it, thanks God, but somehow or other, when you have that, you're not supposed to eat anything. You should really fast. And you just drink glucose water, which is sugary water, but nothing else. These days you would probably get antibiotics, but at that time in India probably that was not available. So you shouldn't eat. However, the mom was so affectionate to the child that she couldn't resist cooking for the child and giving the child food. And of course, being in the child body, it's not that you don't want to eat. Of course you want to eat, but you're not supposed to eat. So basically, if you eat, you die. So the mom killed the child. She had good intention. Prabhupada used that example to make us understand that it's not just about the intention, but we need jnana. We need, the mom should have known that actually, you know, I'm not supposed to give any food to my child because otherwise I kill the child. So jnana is important. The power of discrimination is important to know what is right and what is wrong. What should be done in a certain situation and what should not be done in a certain situation. So that is very good. So in the Vedic scriptures and also in Bhagavad Gita, there is an analogy which says that after many, many births, and not just an analogy, but it's a very nice point of contemplation. After many, many births, a soul comes in contact with real knowledge. So imagine you had already different bodies around your being, and now you're here. So somehow or other, you got in contact with, you were talking about book distribution, you got in contact with somebody who's maybe giving you a book, or maybe a good friend, like in my case, I had 20 years ago, someone that was a neighbor, and she was saying, like, just let's go to Weimar. There's a cool place. And I thought, like, okay, that's good. So the first humble beginnings were very tough, but somehow or other, you know, I kind of couldn't resist. However, the soul comes in contact with bhakti. And actually, it said that the seed of bhakti is being planted in the heart of the living entity. So the seat of bhakti in Sanskrit we call is the bhakti lata, which is the seed which needs to be fructified, which is being planted in the heart. It can be done by a spiritual teacher. It can be done by any devotee. It can be done indirectly by a spiritual teacher, by a person who did write down a book, like the Bhagavad Gita. You read that and you feel, okay, now it's time for me to change life. And I guess a few of you had that experience in their lives, that whenever you understood the real meaning of that philosophy, that you would say like, okay, I really have to, that is my way. You know, there's no other thing, that I have to do this. So all of a sudden, you know, you whatever you've done before is somehow irrelevant. It doesn't really resonate with you much anymore. And you know you have to pursue that certain path. So there is the seed of bhakti, which is being planted in the heart. And it's said that this seed of bhakti is being watered and nourished by the three S. Sadhu Sangha, Seva, which means service. And what was the last one? Shastra. So that is how we can nourish the seed of bhakti, which somehow they got transferred or being planted in our heart. However, around that seed, there's also wheat growing. So it's called seed versus wheat. Not the wheat from the coffee shop necessarily, but the unkraut, which is usually growing anywhere in the garden. And we don't have a real garden at home, but we have a hochbeet. And even there, you have to take out the wheat at times, so that the wheat is not overgrowing the real plant, so that the plant is not getting, you know, or that the plant is actually getting enough light. So there's wheat. And this wheat is very important. This wheat actually is growing as well. That's a natural thing. And we all know we have shadows, do we? At least I have. So we all know what we are, We all know what we are, worst case scenario, capable of. And we all have a memory of what we have done in our lives, like worst case scenario, the things we don't want to talk about, the things we carefully maybe hiding away. So the question basically is, which we are following. Do we follow the seed? Do we follow the wheat? Do we follow, let's say, the seed is the good intention based on bhakti, and the wheat is the polluted mind connected with the ego, remember, which is related to selfish interests, where the outcome is destructive. So we can water the seed, we can water the wheat, it's up to us. In real life, that means which thought do I follow up, or which thought do I give attention? There can be a thought of, you know, maybe I want to smoke a cigarette. Do I give that thought power and attention? And you know there's a saying, where the attention goes, the energy flows. So whatever you focus on mentally, that there is a subtle reaction chain starting. And actually it's said that whenever we make a decision, it becomes a habit. Whenever we make a decision, even if it's once, of course, once is not so bad as 10 times, but if we make a decision in life, whatever it is, good or bad, wheat or seed, that becomes a habit, a habituation. So we become habituated by our decisions. So basically, the question is, what do we water? Where do we give our attention? And of course, you know, there is a cycle of reactions coming after that. So, you know, if you smoke once, maybe that's fine. But if you smoke 100 times, it's already hard. If you smoke 30 years, to take away the cigarettes is a life-threatening situation. That person will probably beat you up. Because that is so deeply ingrained in that personality that that is the main part. So, however, in psychology, they sometimes say, yeah, yeah, but you have to also acknowledge your shadow sides. You know the thing. Right? Like you can't just say, I'm just going for the good, and the rest is not there. To just not pay any attention to what is possible. So how do we deal with that? Because we all have a shadow. And to just say it's not there, to pretend it's not there, is also not honest. And if we press it down, suppress it, don't give any attention or energy to, then maybe that becomes an independent being and is actually catching us from behind. And then all of a sudden we find ourselves in a situation with a lot of, you know, we make troubles which we never thought of we could ever do. So that also is there. So what is the deal in that? We have to, so it is about acknowledging that we have weeds. It's about integrating the weeds. But it doesn't mean that I have to live them out. It doesn't mean that I have to manifest them. Just because, you know, in my childhood I killed a few insects, that doesn't mean that potential of killing is also there to some extent. That doesn't mean that I'm running around with a gun. I'm still following up that tendency. Still I can acknowledge and forgive myself for doing that because it was part of that situation and time. However, acknowledging and integrating that in my personality doesn't mean I have to live according to now. So we have the free will to follow up wheat or seed. That is basically the will, the free will God and Krishna is giving everybody, every living entity, ever since. That we can make a decision, what do we follow? So, like a baby, for example, never really wanted to smoke. You don't have to convince a baby not to smoke. Basically, a baby doesn't know about smoking, so there is no way of convincing a baby not to do so. However, later on, due to sadhusanga, or asadhusanga, due to ashastra, whatever you get the information from, and due to, you know, what was the last S?
Seva.
Yeah? You serve the wrong Lord. Yeah. Then, of course, you create a cycle of reaction, and then that wheat is demanding water at some point. Because when the wheat is so strong that it demands water, and then you actually have to nourish it, even though you might subconsciously know it's not good for me, but you still have to do it because it is already so, the roots are so strong that you cannot just unplug it. So that is important. What are the weeds? There are many weeds. You know, there are weeds such as anger, illusion, arrogance, envy. And one of the main weeds Krishna is talking about with Gita is actually lust. Lust in Sanskrit is called kam, without R, without karma, but it's kam. And there is a very nice verse in Bhagavad Gita, which is the verse which explains the nature of lust. This is in 3:37. And I want to read that out to you because it's a very powerful one. It says, the Supreme Personality of Godhead says, it is lust only, Arjuna, which is born of contact with the material mode of passion, and later transforms into anger, and which is the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world. Very powerful thing. So Krishna is describing that, you know, that selfish interest, that interest of, I want to get something out of it. I want to enjoy that world. I want to enjoy the resources above all. Whether or not I'm harming this person, I'm harming that country, I'm harming that planet, I don't really care because my personal interest is priority. Let's go. So if we read that message, and of course it's hard to just say, okay, I'm off the comm, you know, I mean, we all have that to a certain extent. And it's not bad. We are not like demons after all, just because we have some self-interest. We are in the process of purification, first of all. And second of all, you know, we always have the chance when we read such statements to change something right now. Since many lifetimes, what we heard previously, we might already have different bodies, have had different bodies. So we might have already cultivated some weeds over many lifetimes, where the roots are very strong and where it's not very easy to just uproot them. So we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves just because we realize, oh, there is a habit I don't like, but I cannot yet fully get rid of it. However, we should still try. So that is what the Lord is saying. If you read these verses, they're very strong, but they are meant for us to actually change a certain habituation right now, to replace a habituation with another. Like, you're not following that thought anymore, but you're actually following another thought pattern, and that thought pattern creates another cycle and another habituation, and therefore at some point you are acting out differently than you would do now. So there is a bit of time in between. It's not from today to tomorrow. So that is important. And the thing is, what Krishna also says, we should not mix up what is wheat and what is seed. Because that is also sometimes the case. We take whatever is a wheat for a pure spiritual impulse. And whatever is actually a seed, we neglect or we just take it as a wheat and we would not pay any interest to it. So again, jnan, the power of discrimination based on real knowledge, is very important. That we know what is a seed, what is a weed. Means what are the needs of the body and what are the needs of the soul. So if we take the needs of the soul for the needs of the body and the other way around, if we prioritize wrongly, then we actually put our whole life, our energy into the needs of the body only, neglecting that actually the soul has needs as well. So that is a very important part. So, and we also find this in Bhagavad Gita, when Arjuna represented, let's say he represents the seed, and Duryodhana, he represents the weeds. Yeah, like the Duryodhana has been displayed, if you read Mahabharata, in many like negative ways. You know, he's envious, he's arrogant, he's, you know, whatever, you name it, he has many qualities you would not like to manifest. However, Arjuna is the opposite. Arjuna is truthful, he's devoted, he's a powerful warrior, he's dutiful, he's reliable, and so on. He has the seed qualities, and Duryodhana is part of the wheat compartment, the wheat category. But even then, Arjuna was bewildered. He didn't know. Remember, there's a story in Bhagavad Gita when Arjuna had to let his bow, his Gandiva bow, down. And he said to Krishna, actually, I don't know really what I should do, because I'm bewildered, because I'm in between those armies. And I actually see there are my family members on the other side I'm supposed to kill right now. But deep inside, I don't want to do this. And but somehow or other, you are on my side, so I'm kind of in between two chairs. I don't know really how I should act. So what does he do? And that's a very nice one. Krishna actually showed us by his own example how we can get jnana, or the power of discrimination, because he surrendered to Krishna. And there is a nice verse in Bhagavad Gita 4:34. I'll read that out for you as well, because that is the verse where Krishna is telling how we should inquire real knowledge, or from where we should inquire real knowledge. So how do we get the power of discrimination to be able to decide what is good for us and what is not good for us? He said, just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master. Inquire from him submissively and render service unto him, as again, seva, the seed, nourishing the seed. The self-realized souls can impart knowledge, Jan, unto you, because they have seen truth. So we need to, you know, we recently had a lecture, I guess it was Buddha Bhavana, he spoke in Goloka Dham, where he said, how would it be to see the world from the perspective of Prabhupada? Remember, that was one of those. So, you know, like we see already what Prabhupada has manifested by his intention, by the way. But how if we would see the world from the perspective of a pure lover of God, of a pure servant of God, a powerful one. So, because we can't perceive the nature of reality such as those great souls can do. Therefore, we have to, what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, submissively inquire from them and render service. Means to be active about it. Not just to think about it, it's nice, but also to be active about it. And then the Lord gave Arjuna actually, you know, he spoke the Bhagavad Gita, so that Arjuna, with the power of discrimination, could continue doing his duty. And one nice verse he said is chapter 2, verse 27. You see, nice verses. So I'm reading that one. Krishna says to Arjuna, one who has taken birth is sure to die. And after death, one is sure to take birth again. So therefore, in the unavoidably discharge of your duty, you should not lament. It's very strong. So he says, he also says in another place, all these warriors, they are actually all dead already. Because I, Krishna says, make sure that those who are supposed to die, they will die. Whether you be an instrument of that war, that is your decision. But the outcome is already set, is already fixed. You can't change the outcome. So you could be an instrument to, you know, be a means to an end. But the end is already fixed. So that is a very nice one, just to help us to understand. So now the real good intention. And now we come to where we talk about bhakti. So it was jnana, and now we have the bhakti. So the real good intention, of course, has to be based on what we said, on universal truths, on, let's say, divine paths, and the path, of course, we are following, because we understand the Bhagavad Gita as the essence of Vedic scriptures, is the path of Bhakti Yoga. So the best intention can be achieved by combining or doing it in Bhakti, with Bhakti. So therefore, actually, this verse is very nice where it says, if somebody offers me with love, a fruit, a flower, and so on. So it's not about the thing, but it's about how. It's about the Bhakti. So the intention is very important. And there's a nice verse in CC, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the Adi, in Adi 4, verse 165. This is a very powerful one. And that is one of my one of my favorite verses. It says, the desire to gratify one's own senses is called kama. But the desire to please the senses of Lord Krishna is called prema, the love. So it's a very simple formula. We can make it more complicated, but of course the essence is very simple. So we can check ourselves, where are we standing along that line. So the desire to please one's own senses is calm. And we all have that. It's not that we are all pure devotees yet. Because the pure devotees, they would most probably be on the other end of the scale, where they would only please the senses of the Lord. However, we are somewhere in between. You know, that is one extreme, that's the other extreme. We are somewhere along the way. And we know where to go. We need to know where to go. That is the pinpoint of the map. So that is a good verse to just check up ourselves. If we want to act in bhakti, if we want to perform bhakti, it's good to check ourselves where do we stand along that line? And there are nice verses in Bhagavad Gita too, from the 10th chapter, which are explaining again the nature of bhakti. Chapter 10, verse 8 says, I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who perfectly know this engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. This again, the nature of bhakti. And two verses further along the line, it says, to those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, and again, he says, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. So Krishna is very much emphasizing that point of the intention, how we do it. Good. So, but then is the question, how do we perform bhakti? And it's about bhakti is good. We know now it's loving devotional service. It has to be done somehow in combination to please Krishna. Remember in the beginning of the verse we said it's important to know what he wants so that we can perform bhakti in the most favorable way. But in Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto chapter 2 verse 6, and then I'm stopping with all the verses, it says, the supreme occupation or dharma for all humanity is that by which man can attain to loving devotional service unto the transcendental Lord. It's powerful. Say, the supreme occupation for all humanity is that by which man can attain to loving devotional service unto the transcendent Lord. Also die höchste Form der Tätigkeit, Dharma, an die Menschheit oder für die Menschheit ist die, bei welcher der Mensch es lernt oder zum liebevollen Dienst von Krishna zu kommen. And such devotional service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. So it's about Ahitopi Apratyata. Should be unmotivated and it should be uninterrupted. Those two qualifications are very important if we perform bhakti. Like that. So that is important. So now we have Jnana, we have Bhakti, and now the last point is Vairagya. Remember, we have these three points we want to touch. What is very important to form good intentions. So now Jnana is the power of discrimination. We need to know what is good for us in order to come to the devotional service, and what's favorable, what's unfavorable. And we have Bhakti, which is the loving devotional, actually the essence of where our intention should base on, so we do something to please the Lord. And Vairagya is actually is detachment. So Rupa Goswami explains that we should accept what is favorable for devotional service, and we should reject what is unfavorable for devotional service. So we should accept the right association of people. We should accept the right, input we read or we hear. We should accept the right fruit. As Prabhupada said, in the purport, to eat the right fruit. So the things which are empowering or enhancing our devotional sentiment, we should accept. And things which are, blocking our devotional sentiment, we should carefully avoid, to not water the wheat so much. So Vairagya is the detachment, the ability to detach from things which are blocking our spiritual progress in the matter of advancement in spiritual life. So Vairagya is the power, is actually the power to follow up the discrimination of what is good or what is bad. So you have good association, you do something about it. You have bad association, you do something about it. That is why, rather, you detach yourself from a situation which you know is not good. It's the power of the attachment. So that is there. We need that power, because as he gave a good comment, the modes of material nature are also working. also die materiellen Gunas, die arbeiten. It's not that, you know, you can just live. It's not just peaceful. Peaceful will be in Brahman or Nirvana, however. There's more peace. Or in just sans souci. Without interruptions in Potsdam. However, that is a poor attempt to create Vaikuntha. But actually, here are the material modes. They're working strong. And usually, the modes of ignorance and passion, they're, especially in Kali Yuga, they're quite influential. So we need to know with whom to associate, which activity to follow up. So this vairagya, this power, helps us to come to the level of goodness, to reject activities and situations which are more and more passion and more of darkness, ignorance. So it's important. They are not, the modes of material nature, they are not standing still. They're not waiting for us to make decisions. They act upon us whether we like it or not. Let's say we have to sleep. Sleeping is more or less a bit of a, you know, it's nice, of course, but there's not much conscious activity going on. So it is considered to be a mode of ignorance. Therefore, sleeping has to be. So the modes are constantly working on us. So vairagya, the power of detachment, is important to, you know, to keep us in the right mode, basically. And eventually, to even transcend the mode of goodness. So that is there. Krishna sees the intention and he actually accepts the attitude of the offering. And even if we've done wrong, you know, even if we, you know, there are certain mantras to offer food, even if we don't know the mantras properly, even if we mispronounce, and we usually do all because we are all Brahmana, we are not Sanskrit scholars. So, but because Krishna is not seeing the form, but he sees the intention, the attitude of the offering, and that's what he accepts. He will rectify it, whatever it needs, so that we can also perform it even more perfectly. So then, that is what we call, if Krishna is using somebody as an instrument. He's using that person as an instrument, and then the offering becomes even more beautiful. And that can be a kirtan, that can be, you know, how nicely the deities are being, you know, decorated today. That can be how nicely, you know, Sarashiva is cooking. Or that can be how nicely something is prepared for an event like this. That can be in so many ways. And this I want to do at the end. There's this nice story in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Maybe you've read about it. There's this illiterate Brahmana, the analphabet Brahmana. And I guess it was in Sri Ranga. And then Lord Chaitanya, he was walking there, and then there were all the Brahmanas chanting hymns very perfectly, nicely, and there was this illiterate Brahmana. And this Brahmin was chanting all the 700 verses of Bhagavad Gita every day. But because he was illiterate, he couldn't really read. He was actually having Bhagavad Gita the wrong way around, you know, and he was mispronouncing all the verses. But he was in ecstasy. Tears were coming from his eyes, you know. He had his hair standing on end, so he was displaying symptoms of real ecstasy. However, the Brahmanas, they would only hear the form, they would laugh at him and would say, like, you useless, you're not really, you know, you're not one of us, basically. You can't even read Sanskrit, or to speak of being poetic about Sanskrit. However, Lord Chaitanya came passing by and he would hear the Brahmana reciting the verses, and because he's the one who spoke Bhagavad Gita, Supreme Lord, so he would hear his devotees performing, and he, of course, could see on a material level he was a failure. He was not very, very good in reciting all the verses, but he would hear the attitude, and he would see that actually this Brahmin would manifest even ecstatic symptoms. And then he was asking that Brahmin, so what are you doing? And that Brahmin said, actually, I'm just doing this on the order of my guru. Because he told me to sit down at this place and recite all the 700 verses of Bhagavad Gita every day. And so I do. And whenever I recite the verses, I see that Krishna is dancing within my heart. And that makes me happy. So Lord Chaitanya could see, and he would exemplify this devotee to make a point in materially, he was not qualified. But because he had the right attitude based on seva, shastra, based on jnana, the power of this communication, probably based on Vairagya as well, and most probably based on bhakti. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya was very pleased. And he was actually giving him prem. So he was giving him the highest form of liberation. So, having said that, we can maybe, as a last word, see at the accomplishment of what Prabhupada has done. Prabhupada, who came in a very old age to the West, and by his intention, he would manifest so many beautiful temples, so many beautiful books, so many beautiful jnana to be able to help each and every of the souls who want, of course. So Prabhupada, as an ambassador, would be the one who would plant the seed of devotion within our heart. So now it's for us to follow and to nourish the seed properly. There's a nice thing I read. It says, there's no greater power than a humble devotee pleasing God. So that one, I want to finish today. Thank you so much. It was very nice. Some points just you liked very much, and you feel like, oh yeah, I also have a connective thought about that. Yeah, you can also just to see what's the time. Are we still in time? We're still in time.
You said everyone has a good intention to do something, but if the good intention is not based on the real knowledge, the impact is not positive. And then you also said real knowledge, to get the real knowledge, it's essential to approach a spiritual master and serve him. Only then you will get it. So my question is, to get the, in the first instance, to get the real knowledge, and in the next step to find a proper spiritual master, you need to completely depend upon your good fortune or sukriti from your previous karmas, or how does it exactly work? For instance, even if you are searching for a spiritual master, okay, now I realize like I need to get the real knowledge, now I need to search a spiritual master. And now in India, like there are many spiritual masters. For instance, Art of Living and all, they don't belong to any sampradaya. That's it. I would consider it as a zero level.
Yeah.
Like, okay, you're into trap again. Now you go to the next level. Like, you might fall in the trap of Mayavadis. Okay, that's the second level. And third level, maybe you're into bona fide sampradayas, like Sri Sampradaya or Brahma, Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya.
Yeah.
Then you're almost right. And to pass all through these levels, you need to have a good sukriti, or you just have to depend on your fortune, or is there any other alternative?
It's a good point, yeah. Thank you for the question. So it's about how does good fortune is created, basically. How do we create good fortune? And actually, Prabhupada, in that purport, he said, devotional service is not causal. He said devotional service is not based on a deal which happened maybe in the past or now. So it's not that you know, that we are so good and so whatever spiritual and enlightened that because of what we have done, now finally we are here. And that's it, you know. That, of course, there are different perspectives to look on the matter. Because Prabhupada said actually two things. He said in one occasion, he also said, if one comes to devotional service, that must have been in previous life, that person, Gyata Sukriti, or even Agyata Sukriti, means you have knowingly done something good, or you have unknowingly done something for Krishna. Just if somebody comes on the road and gives you some prasadam, and you eat that prasadam without knowing what it is, but it tastes nice. In some later birth, you know, that little seed is, you know, it intensified by somebody else, and then it breaks out and it creates a desire for more. So that is one part which is most probably there. So whoever sits here, to some extent, we most probably have done something in previous lifetimes for however, but it's hard to say for how long and how much. However, there was, I guess it was Brahmananda, he was asking Prabhupada, so Prabhupada, how is it? You know, is it that one who comes to Krishna consciousness did bathe in all the holy rivers, did read all the scriptures, did, you know, visited all the holy tirthas all around the world, and actually Prabhupada gave a very interesting answer. He said, there may be, but actually, I created your good fortune. So, in the sense that it is causeless. It's confirmed causeless. So, it is causeless. So, at the end, you would say, it is not about our endeavor, what we have done. We might have done or not. You can't really say, but the way of seeing it is that somebody has created that good fortune for us. So bhakti is causeless. There's no deal in that. And so the situation we are living right now, and the opportunity given to us in terms of sadhusanga and whatever we do, nice festivals, is due to the power of a soul having created that good fortune for us so that we can live it. So that is when Prabhupada says there's no cause to bhakti, and that seed of devotional service is being planted in the heart of the soul by a spiritual master or by an enlightened soul without any reason. You could say we have not deserved it, but we still got it. So you get the full price without having maybe even done anything for it. So that is the way we should look at it. However, it can still be, and most likely is, that in previous lives we have done. So these two realities, they live a bit side by side. But for us to become, let's say, favorable and also stay humble, Prabhupada said, he has created that good fortune. So that we not think like, oh yeah, because I have done so much in previous life, I'm already liberated. I'm already a great soul, I'm already a Mahajan, you know, what can you tell me? So that so Prabhupada creates, with that, he creates a proper mindset we should have in order to further advance, because otherwise we might block ourselves at some point. Was that a bit? Mit Mikro oder ohne?
Ja, ich schaff das.
Schaffst du es?
About the, like, back to the verse, where it is said that if we offer with love and devotion, then
yeah.
Krishna accepts. What about if we wake up and we don't feel any love and devotion?
To offer a fruit or flower or
water. Yeah, like we know what to do, but the feeling is missing.
Yeah, that is a very good part, and that is part of everybody's reality, right? Because we have days where we feel more inspired, and we have days where we feel like, actually today I just want to stay in there, to be honest. That happens. But what I like what Prabhupada said also in this verse, like the three S, which are important to nourish that seed. Of course, sometimes we don't even feel like reading. We might not want to read, but then maybe we try the other S, Sadhusanga. And we think of a person who would maybe now be able to inspire us to go a level deeper in our devotional service. And then we follow up that thought by putting it into action and going to that person and just talking about real spiritual matters. Or the last one, what was the last? I always forget. So something. Seva. Or we just perform. Or we just become active, although we might not yet feel it. So you would say fake it until you make it would be the extreme. Yeah, we don't want to maybe have this as an affirmation, as a Glaubenssatz, but still, when, you know, there's this one, I guess also Brahmananda, he asked Prabhupada, he said, yeah, Prabhupada, when everybody bows down, when the pranams are being said, then why should I don't feel it. It was the same question. He said, but I don't feel to bow down and, you know, to say your pranam. And then Prabhupada would say, but anyway, you do it so the feeling comes. So sometimes we have to force ourselves doing the thing, although we might not feel it. Of course, the better is the feeling is there, and we do it with feeling. That is the highest. And even though sometimes we might not have the feeling is not being filled in our heart, we still sometimes do things. This is then more the shell, you know, it's more of a routine. It's not the highest, but it's better than not doing, you would say, until the feeling comes.
I just wanted to quickly comment on that, because
yeah,
I just had recently like this for like a very dark phase of my Krishna consciousness where I didn't feel anything. And actually what helped me pass through was to go before Krishna and tell him, I'm sorry, I don't feel anything, I'm so nothing, I'm so sorry. I really want to give you this fruit with love, but I can't right now. And so please, please forgive me. And
yes,
that was kind of like turning the switch.
The turning point.
Yeah,
right.
And then it,
cool,
then it all cut back. So that
see,
was,
that's a nice way.
Yeah,
to,
that was really.
To actually pray for the feeling. Huh? We
yeah
had in Kodogadam, the art of prayer. So to pray that you feel something, to do something for Krishna. That's a good way of doing it. I got already the signs of that. I have to stop. Thank you so much.